Welcome to Entrepreneur Hour, the only show totally dedicated to entrepreneurs and the companies they lead. The next 60 minutes of powerful insight could change everything you know about success and how it's achieved. Your host, Nance Rosen, is a sought-after executive coach, marketing strategist, and author, conducting seminars on the UCLA campus and around the world. A former executive with Coca-Cola, Nance is now a successful entrepreneur who has spoken to business audiences on four continents. No matter how big your company or where you want to take it, the next 60 minutes will help you build business muscle and propel your career into the stratosphere. Now here's your host of Entrepreneur Hour, Nance Rosen.
This is your host, Nance Rosen, and as you know, we speak to the world's most important people in business communications, career development, and personal well-being. Today is no exception. Today, my guest is David Mattson, a best-selling author with a life-changing new book titled Sandler's Success Principles, 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. David is the CEO of Sandler Training and is with us to reveal how you can change your success trajectory. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nance. It's a pleasure to be here.
David, your new book, Sandler's Success Principles, reveals some of the most profound secrets about how to behave in a selling relationship and in life. The subtitle of Sandler's Success Principles is 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. And today we're going to dig deep into your insights for our audience. My first question is this: what's the number one factor holding salespeople back from being truly effective and abundantly successful in their profession?
You know, Nance, I think when people go to a Sandler program, they're always looking for that magical answer. And they say, you know, I need a better product, or I need a different market, or, hey, you know, now when we're competing in a global marketplace, my pricing's different. And I don't think any of that's really holding people back from being truly effective. You know, we say that luck is really the intersection of preparation and opportunity. And what does that mean? Well, what's holding us back most of the time from getting from where we are to where we want to be in our career is us. It's really between your ears. And we really need to sit back and think about, as a professional salesperson, manager, or anything that we do in our day-to-day jobs, we've got to treat it as a profession and really sit back and ask ourselves, how often do we practice the skills necessary to excel at our craft? And we're looking for those external, I guess, quick and easy fixes. But in reality, if we sat back and said, am I totally committed to what I'm doing? Am I preparing? Am I practicing? Am I rehearsing as if I were a surgeon? I think 90% of the population would have to say, no, I'm not. And so, you know, we teach the success triangle: behavior, attitude, and technique. And those three things are magical in helping any professional take their game to the next level. And T stands for technique. So do we have the technique? Do we know what to say? Do we know how to say it? And most of us are pretty comfortable in that area, although we're looking for the slight edge. Do we have the behaviors? I mean, do we really know what it takes to be successful every single day? And I think most of the people would say, well, not really to that. And that's something we can control. That's something that's not external. And then the A is for attitude. I mean, we all fight this 800-pound gorilla, which is fear, doubt, and worry. And we're dealing with scripts and all the things that we grew up with that maybe really may not be consistent with what we do day to day. I remember my parents telling me, hey, don't talk to strangers. And then I went into professional sales and now I had to cold call, which really means talk to as many strangers as you can. So there's so many different things that we really need to focus in on order to take our game to the next level. Most people look externally. I think really the power is look inside towards yourself, because that's really where we can have the most impact.
Can you reframe someone's brain, or can someone reframe their brain so the stuff between their ears isn't constantly hindering them from being successful and from doing these behaviors? Or when you get someone who's 25, 35, 45, either reading Sandler Success Principles or in Sandler Training, is the stuff between their ears so thick that it's going to be a constant problem to manage for the rest of their lives?
No, I actually think you can, and I believe, and I've seen it thousands of times, you certainly can move past, you know, all that past, wherever it was in your childhood, and you're not stuck where you were. You know, you really just have to, first of all, acknowledge what's going on between your ears. You have to acknowledge that I'm getting messages that may conflict with what I heard and what I experienced as, let's say, a child. And once you acknowledge that and work on that, then that's the first step. I think it's when we don't pay attention to our past messages and realize that those messages made sense. When my parents said, hey, don't talk to strangers, when my parents told me not to talk about money because it was rude, those messages made sense for the time and the situation. Well, I've moved on as a human being, and now I'm in my career being a professional, I have a different set of messages. So I think when we're living in the past and we're not updating all of the messages that we heard and updating all the things that we knew to be true when we were 6, 7, 10, 20, I think that's where we get stuck, because as we know, the world doesn't stop. And that's where if you were just to A, acknowledge it, understand what it meant at the time, look forward and realize this is what I need to do and these are the new set of rules as I live my day-to-day life, wherever you are in your career, at whatever age you are, that's the magic.
And so when you think about the key factors that are holding otherwise competent, maybe even motivated salespeople back, what are the silent killers of some folks that you've seen? And maybe you can tell us a remedy or two or a case or two where you've seen someone be able to turn around this kind of thinking, this kind of attitude, this kind of behavior that's really old school or an old coping mechanism.
Well, I mean, silent killers are everywhere. If you turn on the news, you can see them everywhere. I remember David Sandler saying, sales is a Broadway play put on by a psychologist. And really, what did he mean by that? He really meant that, you know, you've got to remain third party. You've got to really focus in on your customer, not focused in on yourself. And we always say that you really need to ask good questions and focus in on those things. But I think the silent killers for us as individual sales producers are things like dealing with risk and dealing with failure and rejection and a comfort zone. I think so many of us are overcoming all these uncomfortable feelings earlier in our career because we're doing, quote unquote, what it takes to succeed. And we climb that mountain in our careers and we get to a certain level, maybe 3 to 10 years into it. We take a deep breath and wow, I'm successful. I've made it. That doesn't mean you're at the top, but you know that, you know, you're comfortable in your job or comfortable in your life and you want to take a little break. You say, well, let me take a couple months off. I've been working so hard. And then a couple months turns into maybe 6 to 8 months, which turns into 6 to 8 years. And we get caught in what we call the comfort zone. And that's really where, you know, we're stuck, and sometimes we don't know we're stuck. I mean, I believe it's okay to take a rest, but when you take a rest, which extends into years, and you're not pushing yourself because you don't want to risk anymore, and you are afraid of failure and rejection, you really need to separate what we call our IR at Sandler. I is for identity, R is for role. And if we can separate those two, and our identity is who we are as a person, and we say that you're an I-10, you are perfect, and at no point in time when somebody rejects you or you do fail, that you're anything less than an I-10. And you can see these comfort zones every day in the news when you've got professional sports people who may not think of themselves as an I-10, Nance. They say, you know, I'm good, but I'm not great. That doesn't mean professionally. That means to them, their selves and self-esteem. And when they go out and hit a home run and they do fantastically well in their careers early on, and their role side, their R side, goes from nowhere all the way up to an R10. And there's a disconnect, because if I see myself as a middle of the road psychologically, not, you know, an I-10, not an I-3, but right there in the middle, what we find is the people that excel that also don't see themselves at the same level as they're performing in their role, they tend to implode. They adjust. They don't even know they're doing it. But if you think in the music careers of people, professional sports, fighters, how many people are at the top of their game only to do something that we all shook our head at as we watched the news? How could they possibly do what they just did? They had everything. Why did they do that? Well, they didn't do it on purpose. They didn't do it because they wanted to. They did it because at some point what they're doing is making sure that they saw themselves as this I-5 right in the middle. They adjusted their success in their role to match the way they saw themselves from a self-esteem point of view, from an identity, and they got comfortable. And so we have to just acknowledge that we need to constantly pay attention, because the comfort zone principle says that you can only operate in your role 1 or 2 degrees outside of the way that you see yourself from a self-esteem point of view. And so as we watch the news, and you can see it happen all the time, we've got to make sure it doesn't happen in our lives, and you've got to constantly move that flag. One of the things that we could do is journal. You know, we should learn from rejection. Let's face it, in the world of sales, we're going to be rejected more times than we're accepted, and we have to understand that. We have to deal with that and say, well, yes, it's happened. Yes, it's natural. What did I learn? What am I going to do different next time? And the reason why journaling makes sense is because we acknowledge that. We write it down. We also have the ability to go back and remember, because oftentimes our brain is our best friend. We forget all the things that we should have learned from our last failure, and we just repeat them. And that's the mistake. I mean, I want you to go out and try and stretch. That's natural. And the more you move that flag, your personal flag, keep moving it and moving it, you are going to succeed. And along the way, we are going to fail. It's just that's the way the world works.
It's so interesting to hear that a silent killer could be most obviously the fear of rejection, so that would cause someone not to reach out or reach further. It also is sort of astounding to hear you say that the literature is that even unexpected success, meaning the success that you might achieve on a particular call or with a particular client or in a particular arena, that success might throw off your self-image so much that you, what do? You kind of self-sabotage? Is that what happens?
You really do. I mean, I can't tell you how many professional salespeople that have gotten into sales, or maybe they're midway through their career, and early in the year, in any year, they hit a big home run, Nance, and they say, wow, I've hit my quota, and it's March or April. Now, you would have thought that if somebody that is, you know, in the left lane going 1,000 miles a minute to meet and exceed their personal goals, so those benefits are reaped for their family, they would go 2,000% above quota because they've got another 9 months to hit their numbers. But instead, the people that are in that disconnect of the way they see themselves from a self-esteem point of view to their role, what they do is things like, wow, I'm going to go take a vacation. Now, no one holds up their hands and says, I'm self-sabotaging, but they take a vacation. Or they don't service that account and they end up canceling 4 months later. And you say, well, that wasn't my fault. I didn't mean to do that. Of course, I worked hard. I deserve a vacation. And you rationalize that away. And then here's the other thing that happens. Once that success goes away that you got early, and because I felt disconnected to the way I saw myself, then you become a victim. You say, hey, woe is me. You know, that wasn't fair. I didn't get what I deserved. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So as much as failure, yes, is out there, success is equally a silent killer if you don't understand what it means as we're talking about that IR theory. I think it just helps us understand that it works both ways. It's like a seesaw, Nance.
Wow, we're really paying off that subtitle of Sandler Success Principles, which is 11 insights that will change the way you think and sell. That's an extraordinary insight that success throws us off our game sometimes as much as failure and can in fact turn us into a victim. That's just huge. It leads me to my next question, and that is, how important is sales management and personal support, which is, I think, what we're talking about, really understanding the individual and understanding individual self-image and self-concept. How important is that in motivating and controlling and helping your sales force perform versus the kinds of things that we expect from sales management, which is product information and marketing support? What really matters when it comes to getting performance from a sales force?
Well, I mean, hands down, it's going to be sales management and personal support over product or marketing support any time. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we've all seen people succeed despite poor marketing support, despite poor product support, and we've seen people fail when they had excellent marketing support and excellent product support. Why is that? I mean, if you think about sales management, what's the role of a good sales manager? It's to help grow our people. It's to develop the people. We didn't say develop the product. We didn't say develop the market. It's to develop your team. You get production through your team, and therefore you want to make sure that as a sales manager, my team is self-sufficient. And self-sufficient means they're operating as if they're out there and it's you incorporated. So there, all that focuses in on the individual. I mean, if you really think about what we do as sales managers, and I'm code of personal support, is we're out there doing pre-call planning, helping people figure out what are they going to say, what's their goals, what are we doing. A lot of that is self-reflection. And then we set the stage for the call. And, you know, we're doing all the things necessary. We role play. Think about role playing as a sales management function. It's one of the most important things that you could do. And why is that? Because it allows us as an individual to rehearse. I mean, we're rehearsing when you role play. You're practicing. And I go right back down to those life scripts. You know, I practiced as a child to be an adult. Role play is the same thing, but we call it sales management in this function. I get to practice in a safe environment before it's the real event, and then when it happens, I feel comfortable, my confidence is up, my conviction is there. It's almost like the theater dance. We've all been to the theater. They role play all day long. It's called rehearsal. They do act one, scene one, act two, scene two, 1,000 times. And when they're out there, it looks like an art form. It looks like they just did it for the first time. But they did it for 1,000 times. And that's really what, you know, it boils down to sales is a science. It's not an art form. You know, people aren't born a salesperson. You know, when I was born, my mom didn't look down and say, wow, salesperson. No, we became who we wanted to become. And we dealt with all the things, positively and negatively, that are thrown at us from the environment and from our past and what we deal with, our fears and scares. And we are the best that we can be. And so the practice and the role play, that is creating the new reality, if you think about it, because I'm taking a future event and bringing it into the present, something that has not occurred. I'm practicing it. And so my changes my whole mindset. I feel confident. You know, think about those who golf. We can talk ourselves in and out of a bad round. You know, I can say, don't hit the water, don't hit the water, don't hit the water, and all of a sudden, boom, I've hit the water. Or I can go and practice for 3 hours at the driving range. And when I'm at the driving range, what is that actually doing? It is role-playing, and I'm feeling confident. I'm feeling conviction. I've got all the kinks worked out. When I walk up to that first tee, I'm feeling good about that. So it's important. And I think sales managers also debrief. Why is that important? Well, when it comes to personal support, it's because right then you can say, what happened? What did you like about it? What would you do differently? And it allows me to change back all the things that I wish I had done. I can deal with it now. I take all that negative stuff in the past and the successful things and say, I want to replicate what I just did there, and I want to replace what I did there because it didn't work out. and it helps me as I move forward. I think a confident salesperson that has conviction in themselves and in their message far outweighs any other support they're going to get externally. So sales managers have such an important role in that personal development. And personal support is key. I mean, think about you want somebody to talk to, and you're going to go and do all the things that we need to, even if we do our own self-support for a second, which is to sit back and just say, here's what's going to happen. I don't need a sales manager to do that. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to visualize. And what happens if they ask me this question? I'm going to respond here. Hey, what happens if they bring up the fact that we had a bad experience with that company a year ago? Here's what I'm going to say. Because if I don't do that, sometimes what happens is we get sucked in. And when somebody says something that we're not expecting, they almost get to enter into our castle. You know, when I go into a call, I zipper myself up and I say to him, I'm in the castle. You can't come in without my permission. And that's really key. So I only let people into my castle if they have permission. And that's true here. And all the things that we talked about there helps you build that castle for yourself to protect yourself emotionally and to also say, I am going to succeed despite all the environmental things that are going on, because I can only control what goes on between my ears. I can't control what my prospect says. I can't control what's going on in the environment with all the globalization. I can't control the economy. But this stuff here, I can control. And if I worry about the things that I can control, then I've won.
Well, we're definitely leading into the next question. We're going to go to break, but I want to tease it a little bit, which is, you know, what is the most difficult task for managers to do well, and that may include people who are self-managing. It sounds like we're going to be talking about creating a new reality. So when we come back, we'll be dealing with that, which is a great, great insight that you also get from Sandler Success Principles. We are with the author, David Mattson. Once again, Sandler Success Principles, one of my favorite subtitles ever, 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. Sit with that for a moment, and we'll be back. And we are back. This is Nance Rosen, and we're with David Mattson, the CEO of Sandler Training, and also the author of Sandler Success Principles, 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. David's been talking about some really key concepts. He mentioned the concept of being in a castle, and hopefully we're going to get to mine that right away. I'm sure that piqued your curiosity. The question that's up right now, David, is what's the most difficult task for managers to do well when it comes to helping their sales representatives perform optimally? You mentioned this concept of a castle. I suspect that that's among the things that's missing from the quiver of most traditional sales managers, or certainly business owners who have a sales force.
It's absolutely true, Nance. I think that the castle that we're talking about is that, you know, we always have disappointment. We have stalls and objections and put-offs. And really, we've got to make sure that at the beginning of the day and during a call that our self-worth, our identity is intact, and we're not allowing people to go and just kind of take little chunks away. You can see people going into a call after a tough day, their shoulders are hunched, their head's down slightly, you know, they're kind of walking slow. They've lost before they've ever entered the call. And on the flip side, though, we've seen how success can also propel people where their shoulders are back, their head's up, they're walking confidently. And what has occurred? I mean, really, an external thing, which may have been a win or a loss in the call before that, but more importantly, it's how we dealt with it. And again, I go back to an earlier comment. We're going to be rejected more than we're going to be accepted. That's fact. And so how we deal with it, and how we allow those feelings to really affect the way that we operate is really up to us. I mean, I think sales managers, one of the most difficult tasks that we have is to really create a common process, a common language. And we're talking about all the things that are between our ears that we can help. It's our insights. And it helps us as salespeople to understand a common process. I'm here now, stage one. I'm going to go to stage two, and here's what's required in stage two, and here's what's required in stage three. And knowing that lowers my anxiety, certainly. I think most salespeople go out and wing it. They don't have a common process. And sales managers, to manage to five or six different selling approaches on my team is very, very difficult. Because if you think about what we're talking about, if I have common process, which means then I can have common sales language, then I'm training to that. I'm training. This is what you do in these steps, and here's how you say it, and here's how you behave. And when I know those things, and I can see the path, and I know the goal for each stage in my selling process, then I'm feeling confident, and I'm feeling convicted. And I can also learn from that, because I know if I did something poorly or if I did something that was wonderful, I can self-adjust. But when I don't have a common process, it's like I'm circling the airport without any landing zone. I know I just failed, but I don't know why, and I don't know what to do to get any better. And so I think if you have that common process, it's great. You get to coach, you get to train. And we're back to what we were talking about before. I can do all the pre-call stuff that I need to do and all the role-playing, all the things that are going to help that confidence and conviction, and it allows me to self-adjust as a professional. And I don't have people managing me day to day, but I do manage myself. And if I can have that roadmap, that common methodology, then I'll say, hey, I did great here, here, and here. I should have said this. You know, when they said this to me, I got sucked in emotionally for a minute. I got emotionally involved, and I shouldn't have done that. And here's what happened. I responded too quickly, or I didn't think about this on a bigger picture. I think salespeople, we get sucked in emotionally when we really shouldn't. I'm back to that sales is a Broadway play put on by a psychiatrist. When we know that, psychiatrists are really focused in on that buyer as we talk. They're asking good questions. You know, good salespeople should have their prospects talking 70% of the time. They should be listening. So we really want to make sure that we're set up to do that. But if we're having our minds talk to ourselves, self-talk, and doing all the things that, you know, we're having all this conflict internally, we're not listening to our customers, actually. And we're not asking good questions. And we're not following process. So it's a domino effect that's out there. But I do think one of the most difficult tasks is to make sure that they have that common process. Now, here's the other thing that most sales managers struggle with, which is to have management courage, which is to have that difficult conversation that you may have to have with salespeople, and to do it in a nurturing way. Because when we give feedback to people, we don't want to come right at them. Hey, what did you do? Hey, you should have done that differently. And why did you say that in this circumstance? I know emotionally we want to come right out and say what the heck is going on, but sales managers really have to manage from what we call nurturing parent. And 70% of selling should come from nurturing parent, and certainly 70% of management, which is, you know, you want to create that environment where people feel comfortable and they can learn from that. Hey, I like the way you did that. And you give them some strokes and you give them some positive feedback, but you do it in a nurturing way. I learned a long time ago, it's not what you say to people, Nance, it's how you say it. And I think you can say just about anything and give constructive feedback in so many different avenues. And what we are trying to say is don't do it from a critical parent when you're attacking and you know you're doing it because your finger's out and you're kind of pointing as you do it, but more from that nurturing parent. If you go back and think about mom for a second, you know, she could tell you not to do some things and to have some learning situations. But at the end of the day, the message was received and it wasn't discounted, because there's a rule. If you attack people with what we call the critical parent, you shouldn't have done that. When most people automatically will defend, and when you defend, you're not going to change. You're just drawing that line in the psychological sand saying, no way. And so I think if you do it from a nurturing parent, you make it safe for people to change their behaviors, to change the way they do things, and to look at things differently. And that's really important as a sales manager, and I think we forget that.
Well, it sounds like among the most difficult tasks for managers and business owners is not personally getting tied into what's happened either. Because when we think about business and we think about the role of a sales force or a salesperson, that person gets rejected or that person gets shut down. Well, for a business owner at an arm's length, the same thing has happened. That opportunity is lost. And so the ability not to take that emotionally, but rather than to counsel, coach, continue to work with a salesperson, getting over yourself is an expression that, you know, we use in our organization, the getting over the rejection and the quantifying of what that costs the organization. Sounds like sometimes managing from within your own organization is a particularly tough task.
Well, it really is. I mean, if you think about that, we don't want to get emotionally involved when we're managing, right? I think that we so desperately want our people to succeed, and we so desperately want to succeed as individuals. There's no stopping that. We want to. But the fact of the matter is that if we're emotionally involved and we're a sales manager, we've missed an opportunity potentially to have a learning experience. I've watched so many salespeople on a call with their sales manager, Nance, and they were supposed to be there to observe, stay third party, offer coaching after the fact, and the sales manager got emotionally involved. The salesperson maybe didn't answer the question that the way that they were hoping, maybe didn't really complete the answer. Next thing you know, the sales manager jumps in and quote-unquote saves the day. You can almost see them off to the side ripping off their shirt so that you can see the super S, super salesperson, right, branded on their thing, saying, I'm here to save the day. But they weren't there to save the day. They were there to add coaching and counseling and you know, be there to support. And so what happens? Well, first of all, you sent the wrong message to your salesperson. You know, you say, hey, look, you know, I'm going to rescue you all day long. And remember the rule for sales managers. We wanted you to create an environment of self-sufficiency. And when you do that, there really wasn't a learning experience because it didn't unfold. Inevitably, salespeople will say to a sales manager who rescues them, well, I was going to do that, or I was going to get there, or, man, there's no way I could have done that. And that actually causes the same amount of trouble for a sales manager when a salesperson says, there's no way I could have done what you did. I think we have to learn from failing, and we have to let it occur, and you get more from, we're back to that role play, in your curbside critique, if you just kind of bite your lip as a sales manager, take your ego out of it, of course you would have done differently. But everyone would have done differently. I mean, it's second nature. But let it happen. You know, unless it's horrific and you're going to, you know, they've made they've disclaimed something that wasn't true, then let it happen. You know, I've always found that you can save the deal later. And then use that moment after the fact, you've seen it played out, and to do some coaching and do some training and some mentoring and use that nurturing parent that we're talking about and protect their identity. Make sure that when you give feedback, it's on the role side, not on the you side. You should have done this. You should have done that. That's identity stuff. Remember, you want your salespeople to be an I-10, because if they're an I-10, they'll perform very high on their role side. If you deflate their identity and push them down, especially because it makes you feel good as a sales manager at some level, boy, I'll tell you what, all you're doing is driving down productivity of your salespeople. And so I'll always start off with, hey, what did you like about that call? Okay, and then I'll say something about the role. How did you think the upfront contract, or how do you think your questions about it was received? And maybe I'll show you a way that I would have done that, or what I saw some other people in the field respond to that question. And now I'm just giving them role feedback. It's such a subtle difference, but if for a salesperson receiving that message, I'm open to that message, and I will actually utilize what you tell me versus the other way where I've gotten beaten down by a bat, literally, And I'm like, wow, you know, I'm not doing that. Or you start doing self-talk and you have these wonderful conversations with yourself about finding a new job and all those other things that we do. And we've all done it 1,000 times.
David, I've got to bring in Sandler training at this point, because beyond the book, and the book does mention this, there is a role for an outside coach, and it sounds like this is a sensitive place where an outside coach, like a Sandler trainer, really plays an important role. How does a trainer interact with the sales force, with the sales manager? Is it an intervention kind of role? Is it a teaching role? What goes on in a training or a training relationship?
Well, I think that when you go to a Sandler training center, first of all, we believe in ongoing reinforcement training. I don't think you're going to go from, you know, where you are today to the optimal point in your career overnight. If it was as easy as that, we'd all have done it. So I think that we get to work at our own pace. So, you know, we have programs for sales managers and salespeople, and you get to, A, go to the programs that make sense to you, but you also get to hear it numerous times. I know when I hear something new, I actually take a mental vacation for a second. I go off, and I'm processing what you said. By the time I come back, I may have missed another 10 minutes. So I think repetition is a good thing. But I also think that when you hear content, the second part of the magic is that you get to come back and say, here's the situation. What should I do? And it's in a very safe environment. You know, you didn't tell us that you've already booked the sale. It's not in my pipeline. And you get to tell me very openly, here's where I am. What should I do? And then we role play, but in a way that will play you as a salesperson. You get to play prospect because you know what the prospect's going to say. But more importantly, just from human psychology, watching a Sandler trainer play you and do all the things that we're going to suggest that you do to move this sale forward or disqualify this sale, you're watching. You're not emotionally involved because you're not playing salesperson. You're not the one who's got to be on the spot to come up with the magic one-liners. We're actually illustrating it for you. We're demonstrating it for you. And then you can replicate it. And so that's so important for sales managers and salespeople. Think about sales managers for a second. Most sales managers got absolutely no training prior to going into their job. There was an opening in sales management. Leadership came in, looked around, and said, you over in the corner, you're the top producer. And Mary, I'd like you to be the new sales manager. I want you to go and manage the people and replicate yourself, replicate your success. And we'll be here any way that you need us to help you out, Mary. But Mary inside saying, well, my gosh, how do I replicate myself? I don't have those skills necessarily. I know what I did. I'm not sure I could actually repeat it out loud, step one, step two, step three. But secondarily, if I ask leadership, they're going to think that maybe I wasn't qualified. So that it's amazing how many new sales managers don't reach out for help and don't say, well, help me do that. And how many companies that we all know that are very successful, they don't have an onboarding program. And so what we offer is a track for sales managers to learn how to be sales managers, to learn how to transfer what they did so wonderfully in the sales side and bring it into the management side, and to make their people more effective and more efficient, but also to help themselves grow. How do I become a manager? How do I deal with my own self-talk? How do I become, quote-unquote, a psychologist for the people that work for me? How do I help them grow? There's so many things that they have to do that we're not equipped, much like we were not equipped when we come into the sales profession. We talked about that earlier. I mean, that's a road that most of us have to learn by fire. And I just think it's so much easier to take the 250 training centers that we have and bring all those best practices so you can shrink that learning curve down to months or a year versus 10 to 20 years of your career. I think the greatest thing, the greatest testament, when you hear people that have been in it for a little while and they'll come up to a trainer, a Sandler trainer, and they'll say, I wish I knew you 20 years ago. You know, if I knew what I know now, and it's just slight tweaks, it's implementing best practices, it's behaving differently, thinking differently, and then having the right words at the right time, has made such a huge difference. And that's really what it boils down to.
Well, can you imagine if you knew now, or you knew then, rather, what you know now, if you've gone through this kind of training, if you understand these kinds of principles, and you can actually use them? I think also the idea of doing all of this in a really safe and nourishing place where you're not risking revealing what you don't know to people who you think are evaluating you or judging you, but really people who are supporting you. It's we talked about what an internal organization probably can't do, and I think we've definitely gotten to the heart of that. When we come back, we're going to talk about something that is near and dear to fear in the hearts of most salespeople. David touched on it, and that is prospecting. And this phobia that most folks have when it comes to not just prospecting and sales, but reaching out to anybody new for anything, which is becoming increasingly important in the global environment in which we have and the environments that that presents. Once again, we're with David Mattson, who's the CEO of Sandler Training. His new book is Sandler Success Principles, 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. Stay with us. We'll be back. And this is Nance Rosen, and we're with David Mattson, and he's the author of Sandler Success Principles, 11 Insights That Will Change the Way You Think and Sell. I promised we'd come back with the question I think most of us have. Anytime you mention fear, everybody's ears prick up. And the question that we often get about salespeople is, what's so terrible about prospecting? And really, David, why are so many salespeople almost phobic when it comes to picking up the phone or in any way reaching out to the folks who are really going to be responsible for their success and the success of their organizations by actually doing deals?
Well, you know, Nance, when I watch a Sandler trainer get in the middle of the room and make an outbound cold call on a speaker phone where the audience can hear it and they're calling people that the audience gave them, you can see people just mesmerized, their jaws drop. No way, that person's going to make an outbound call to somebody on my list. They don't even know what we do. You can see all the fear and the anxiety of that audience trying to be transferred to the trainer. And the trainer is up there confident, doing their thing. Why is that? Why is there such a phobia when it comes to prospecting? Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons. Certainly, we can boil some of them down to, I'm not sure people really know what to say on the phone. And they don't practice. That's certainly one of them. You know, I know we teach a very easy script. We call it the no-pressure script. And the emphasis of that is to have a preoccupation breaker. Let's face it, they didn't expect your call. So you automatically pick up the phone, Nance, and people are like, well, who are you? And all of it, you're like, you're caught off guard. I mean, it's not like people sit around in today's environment waiting for inbound cold calls. It doesn't happen. And so we also feel anxiety, we feel pressure, we have all these feelings which get transferred over the phone. If you listen to people's tonality when they call a friend, it's completely different than when they call somebody they don't know. And so I think if we just had our part down and we practiced it and not necessarily sounded like the traditional salesperson, I think that's part of it. You know, I think that if you sat there and just practiced your script, you know, X amount of times, regardless of what you're using, I think ours is better. But regardless of what you're using, I think you're going to be better off. People don't do enough of it. And because they don't do enough of it, they don't get comfortable. They also conjure up all these terrible things that happen. You know, they may even have, you know, somebody had hung up on them a year ago, and they have what I'm going to call reach back or afterburn, which is these things happened to them a while back, and then they went back in their mind and said, oh my gosh, this could happen to me again. And guess what? It may. It's no big deal. But, you know, these are fears and scares of things that happened in the past. Remember that phrase that we use that, you know, no one can enter your castle without your permission. We are going to get rejected, but you're going to have what we call a cookbook, which is create a daily behavior plan. If you knew in your heart that you had to do 10 of these a day, and these 10, knowing your numbers, would get you to your goal, you could probably put up with it because you would create what we call a prospecting plan that says, I need X amount of these types of calls every day, and then once it's done, then I'm off to something else. And I'm, of course, I have to get better at this every single day, but I would know that there's an end and there's a start. I would also then say, look, I can control those calls. I'm not saying you have to get 10 yeses. All I'm saying is you have to make 10 outbound calls. And now I'm back to controlling what I can versus controlling people picking up the phone, which we know is harder these days, and giving me a positive response, which is harder. And your number may not be 10. It may be 50. I know when I first started, sales, I would sit there and say, I've got to make 50 outbound calls. And I went out and bought a deli counter. And I went out and I started the number at 50. That's like what you would go up to the local food store and they would see now serving 63, now serving 64. And I bought it and I would start it at 50. And every time I made a call, it would go down one. And then I would hit it and go to 49, to 48, to 47. So I was counting on my own because I said, well, I could put up with this for 50. But when I didn't have that, I would sit and fidget. I'm like, oh my gosh, not another one. I must have made 600 calls today. And I looked down at my call list and I made 4. I said, well, oh my gosh, how did that happen? It's close to lunch. Let's take lunch. You know, and then I would suffer through and then let's take, I need a coffee break. And my whole day would be shot. So by creating the plan, I said, well, I need to get 50. Now, I may have gotten rejected 39 times. I didn't do that. I was just getting to the 50. I could control it. It was manageable. I got to celebrate each and every day because I got through the 50 and I hit my number. I got this huge goal of X amount of revenue. I broke it down to daily behaviors, which I, as I said, I could control it. It was beautiful. So that's there. And I also think because if people don't have what I'm going to call a cookbook, we've got call reluctance. I mean, this calling of the unknown, we're back to these scripts. We're all kids. You know, we learned certain things. Hey, don't bother people, right? Kids should be seen, not heard. Hey, don't talk to strangers. All these things that I did as a child to grow up to be a perfect adult, I went to work for somebody who said, hey, listen, you better be heard, buddy. And you better go talk to strangers, and you better go talk about money, and all the things that my mother told me for years not to do. It was a complete disconnect for me. And that's why, as we talked about earlier, you need to update those messages, because once you update those messages, you realize, hey, at 6 and 5 and 4, those were appropriate messages. As a matter of fact, I tell my kids that. But we've got to figure out what to do when you're in sales.
So there's a lot of what's going on between our ears that's telling us that this is dangerous behavior, that picking up the phone is dangerous, it's hazardous, it's got strangers involved. And so those are old messages. It sounds like that's part of it makes perfect sense. It also sounds like some of it is pretty simple. We talk about good daily habits, and I don't know how much of success is simply good daily habits, but good daily habits sounds like this cookbook or a daily behavior plan. Is that really a central feature to getting people in control of their behavior and getting control of the things that lead to success? Is it good daily habits, or is it more this kind of larger future goals? These are the things that I will have: a beautiful house, holidays with my family, security. Which is the thing that tamps down fears the most? Which is the thing that drives us the best?
Well, I think we all want those big goals, right? I will have the vacation house. I will send my kids to college. I will do all those things. That's initially what gets us motivated. And that's certainly, if you have a behavioral plan, which I'll talk about in a second, that keeps you going throughout the year. I mean, that is a driver. where 90% of the population falls apart is they say, well, I don't know how to get there. And all of a sudden, these big dreams become a wish, a hope, you know, and they're not really goals. And all of a sudden, we get feeling pretty bad about that because we have no plan to get there. So I think that's a motivator, but really what it boils down to is how to turn those goals into reality. And so how do you do that? Most people do not know, Nance, how much it costs them to wake up every single day. They don't know the number. And then if we add our goals on top of that, if I did want that second house, I do want the college education, how much does that cost every day for me to save? I can't just wake up one day when I hit 45 and say, okay, well, where's the $100,000 for my kids to go to school? It doesn't work that way. You've got to save each and every month. We all know the rules. But if we say, okay, if I need the money, how, what do I do every day? What activities are necessary? What daily behaviors are necessary? You can ask 100 salespeople the following question, and you'll find that 90%, 92% will not know the answer. You'll say, how many unique conversations do you need every single week in order to hit your goal? And they'll look at you and you say, well, what do you mean? I have a $10 million quota. Okay, I understand that. But how many unique conversations do you need with prospects? Not second calls, not third calls, but how many unique ones? First time. They don't know the number because what they haven't done is taken their personal goals or their corporate quota and broken it down into things that they can control every single day. Because once you do know that number, and let's just pretend the number is 10, I need 10 unique conversations, then you say to yourself, where are they coming from? And there comes the prospecting plan. Well, if I need 10, and where would they come from? My first step is to write down all the possible ways that you could find a prospect, and then determine which ones you'll actually do. I mean, there's certain things that I know I will not do, and there's certainly things that I know I can do. So if I came up with 25 different ways to find a prospect, I said, you know what? I like those 10 because I know I'll do those every day. I'm not going to trap myself into doing things that I know I'm not going to do. Out of those 10, how many prospects will come from each source? Well, if one of them happens to be referrals, I know that I should go out and get 2 to 3 referrals. And maybe I have a track record of a year knowing that every month or every week I get a certain amount of referrals. What's that number? If you get a certain amount of referrals, great. If then you say, okay, where are the rest coming from? It may come from alliances. It may come from you making outbound calls. You have to determine where it is. But don't just pick a number. Well, I need 10 unique conversations. And we sit at our desk and we just wait. When they come in. We can't control that. Let's deal with what we can control. Determine the source and then go get them. Because here's the other thing that's enlightening for salespeople. If I need 10 a week or 30, right, or 40 a month, and I'm midway through the month and I don't have my numbers, I know it right then. I know that I've got to adjust my activity. I need to increase what I'm doing. And I won't play a victim because I can control my own behavior. I can control my activity. So I'm in charge. I'm in total charge of my plan. And that's great. So it gives me this prospecting plan, gives me the power, gives me the confidence, gives me the conviction, gives me the ability to adjust it if it's not working. I don't have to wait for these magical external sources. And then also, here's what happens with sales managers that don't help their people create a prospecting plan. You'll hear people say, where are my leads? If you want more sales, give me more marketing. And they, you know, they're waiting for the bluebirds to jump through the window. Top producing salespeople use marketing and use all this stuff as bluebirds. They're going to go out and deal with the things that they can control. So prospecting plans are perfect. They feed your cookbook, which are all the daily activities. And that is simply a breakdown of what your personal and professional goals are. And that connection is magical.
it really does sound like it. And I love the idea that you add to it that there are certain things that I won't do, certain things that I can do, and therefore certain things that I will do. And that really seems to take some of the sting out of the, oh, I have to do all these things, but that I can actually quantify what works and also kind of allow for who the individual is. And I love the tip. I'm all about tips and techniques. The idea of buying a deli counter and counting down or having a clicker or something else that allows you to see that you are making success, you are moving toward your plan goals, whatever they are, is absolutely, it's huge. It's very inspiring, as so much of this work is. David, when you look at the downside and you look at the people who aren't performing, who have maybe the same information that other folks have, but the average and the below average sales representatives, what are they doing in contrast to the superstars, the folks who are really exceeding, meeting and exceeding their goals regularly? Is it this kind of planning? Is it planning plus? What's going on?
Well, I think that the people who just kind of show up and throw up that product knowledge, they don't have a plan, they don't have process, they don't have a daily behavior, it's kind of hit or miss. You can see there's spikes in their sales process. They go from feast to famine, and then they're wondering what's going on. They take rejection personally. I think that, you know, that is a person who happens to be in sales but doesn't necessarily treat it as a profession. I think the ones that are really doing a fantastic job consistently are doing a couple things. One, they are treating it like a science. It's not, you know, I'm not born. It's not an art form. I think if you practice and you do all the things necessary and you follow the methodology, then it looks like an art form. I think they focus in on their buyer, again, versus focusing in on what's important to me as a salesperson. I need to make quota. I need to do this. And if I look at the overall sales process for a minute, Nance, I think that there's some huge differences between those that are successful in a consistent manner and those who are not. And one of them happens to be what we call the upfront contract. And that is setting the stage. It happens to be the second part of our selling process. But if you can go in and set the stage with your prospect or your customer, I mean, let's take a prospect as an example. You know, they don't know what to expect. You sell what you sell every day. They buy what you sell occasionally. They forgot your name, most likely. They looked down 10 minutes before you showed up and realized your name was Bill Smith. And so you may have been thinking about this call for a week, a month. They've been thinking about this call maybe for 20 minutes, especially if you begged your way into a call versus doing a proper call on the phone to even get the appointment. And so that upfront contract sets the stage. I believe a call that starts well ends well, and a call that starts poorly tends not to get much better, right? That's when the prospect looks at their watch and says, you know, this has really been interesting, but we've got a ton of fires here today. If you'd be nice enough to put what you said in writing and send it to me, we will give it some serious consideration. And that's when you know it's gone horribly wrong. But the upfront contract does five basic things. One, it sets the stage for time, right? How much time are we going to have today? Because if you're focused and care about your prospect, if they do have fires, know about it now. Hey, say it may be a better day. If you thought you were going to be there for an hour and they said to you, hey, I've only got 15 minutes today because it's insane, hey, be considerate. They'll thank you for it. Well, they'll say, no, let's give it a shot. Tell them why you're there. Because even though you know why you're there, they may not know why you're there. Why don't you ask them the two or three things that are most important to them that they want to see you cover today before the end of the meeting? That's important. How about this? Tell the customer or prospect, these are the two or three things that I want to discuss today. When you give people plenty of notice of what you're going to talk about, they can actually participate. You know, sales is a conversation. Sandler's a conversational sales model. When you spring upon a prospect, a topic, how can they participate? But I'll tell them in the first 3 to 5 minutes, here are the two or three things that I want to cover today. It gives them time. They may ask me for clarification. They may tell me I don't want to cover that. And guess what? We renegotiate our agenda, and that's great because people hate to be sold, but they love to buy. And then we'll talk about, hey, at the end of the meeting, let's talk about some of our next steps. And you set the stage for that because people know inherently that there is going to be some next steps. So talk about them up front. When I tell somebody at the beginning of a first call that, you know, today a lot of things could happen, but if we think that there's a fit based on the amount of time we spent with each other, the next step in my process is that you invite me back for 3 hours. And during that 3 hours, the following will happen, and I explain it. Boy, you can see the anxiety disappears because they know what to expect. They ask me such great questions. The call takes a completely different life cycle because now they're participating. Now they're trying to decide as well, do I want to invest that 3 hours? It's perfect. You know, an unsuccessful salesperson springs the close on the prospect or customer, you know, 49 minutes into a 60-minute call, and we're back and forth. So that's important. I think that the pain step is completely different and separates those who are great at sales.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Hour. Email the show anytime at ceo@entrepreneurhour.com.